Now, Gregory Wilson will speak to us on the divine mind, wisdom, and perfect behavior.
You laugh. Yes, I thought that perfect behavior was good. Something we all can achieve. Yesterday morning at 10 o'clock, I participated in a service called Eyes Wide Open. And this service was not anti-war, more peace and remembrance oriented. And what it was an exhibition where the boots of the service people who have died in the wars in Iraq and Iran, Afghanistan, were placed in such a way, and it was really a very beautiful setting. I mean, it was in a breezeway, and the flag was behind it, and it was just, it couldn't have been, however you could think about that, it was a perfect place for remembrance and honoring these people who have died in these wars. And up behind, they were there. Then over here were shoes of civilians, of Iraqis who have died. And it was pressed upon me as a minister who would participate in this that this was not an anti-war process. This was a remembrance and peace process. And something has occurred to me that I think we, myself, us, our culture, has a difficult time on maintaining some sense of oneness in these terms. That this was about peace. This was about remembrance. This wasn't about war or anti-war in a way. It was about having some sense of remembrance and peace, period. And I've been told later, it lasted from 10 to 5, that at least one protester came. And as I told stories in here before, that people protesting peace are over and against peace, and they can't seem to understand that peace is not about anti-war. It's something different. There's a theologian named H. Richard Niebuhr who wrote during the 1930s, 40s, late 20s, 50s, and 60s, and he participated in helping people escape from Nazi Germany. And I'll say it again, I've said this numerous times, I have respect for theologians who write about the horrors of war and who write some sense of ultimate value, having an understanding of destruction and what I would consider evil. And he wrote a book, called Christ in Culture. And essentially what he was trying to say is that in culture, there's five different ways people understand Christ. And these are, if I can remember five at this minute, it seems to be slipping my mind, all of them. But Christ of culture, Christ accommodating culture, Christ over and against culture, and Christ transforming culture. What this has alerted me to is that our culture does a lot of over and against. We can't seem, as a culture and as individuals, to get to the point of individual sense of peace or individual sense of love and have that be beyond everything else. We can't get there. And as long as we can't get there, we will always be an over and against people, an over and against something. And I'm going to suggest that this sense of being over and against is deep within the psyche of not just our culture, but of Western civilization. It's just deep within us. When we take some understanding of our spiritual lives and our spiritual heritage, you know, the words come up for me of we would like to see universal love, we would like to see universal compassion, but at the same time, it has occurred to me that universal love and universal compassion are not values of Western civilization. Universal love and universal compassion, just that thought, is not a value of Western civilization. It certainly wasn't a value of the Empire of Rome. It certainly wasn't a value of the Babylonian Empire. It certainly wasn't a value of the Persian Empire. It certainly wasn't a value of the church. It certainly wasn't a value of our sense of manifest destiny, because when we think of ourselves, and we think of ourselves as over and against, or we think of ourselves as other, or we think of ourselves as more superior, universal love and universal compassion has no place there. It was a year ago, I was working on a sermon just entitled Love, and when I got to this Dictionary of Pastoral Care and Counseling, that dictionary, it has all the answers of the universe in it. And in that dictionary, so I'm searching for this, and I search love, and it comes to Christian love. And it says that Christian love was that love expressed within the Empire of Rome. This is talking about the origins of Christian love. Therefore, anything outside of the boundaries had no sense of Christian love. Which means we could do anything we wanted to those who lived outside those boundaries. It didn't matter. Within the United States, as United States citizens, we have or had certain rights. But those outside of our boundaries don't have those rights. We can treat them how we want. The values of Western civilization, when we look through history, are subordinating people, are slavery, of classism, of a sense of superiority, not a sense of universal love and universal compassion. We've been on a journey, I suspect, for the past 4 months or so, on trying to understand the origins of justice. And I think this is related to this over and against mentality we do not seem to be able to escape. Just another example, I've got to say it, this other example. There was probably 2 years ago, I believe it was MoveOn.org, or I forget the organization, that sponsored health care for everyone, and that we were to go march on the bridges and walk across bridges all across America to bridge the gap of health care. It seems pretty simple to me, in my mind. Of course we'd want health care for everyone. Not health insurance for everyone, but health care for everyone. And so we were on one of the causeways, and there were people who protested health care for everyone. Some obscenely protested and expressed anger. And I'm still trying to get my mind, how could we be over and against health care for everyone? How could you protest that? How can we escape this mind of over and against? And even as I watch my habits of the television shows that I watch, in terms of this over and against, I'm watching it there. How many of us watch detective shows? The very first 2 minutes is demonstrating to us who's going to be over and against who. Everything is over and against. We're indoctrinated over and against. But somewhere, these words, universal love, universal compassion, these thoughts, these concepts, have also been in Western civilization. Not through the power structure, not through those who govern the people, but they've been there. So where do they come from? How do they remain in existence when there seems to be so much power over and against universal love and compassion? How many people have watched the presidential activities and you listen to a candidate like Dennis Kucinich? And Dennis Kucinich is a man, if we had to say who's closest to socialism or FDR or that, maybe it would be Dennis Kucinich. And ideals clearly that would benefit a larger group of people than others. He was shamed, ridiculed, made fun of. We've seen more pictures of his wife than we have heard about words from him. But he was the closest to universal love and universal compassion. The closest. So we've taken this journey of searching for the origins of justice. And we looked at the Hebrew prophets and found it there. And we looked at the years 500 BCE to 1000 BCE, and we know something different happened during that era of time because we hear this cry for justice. Don't steal money from the poor. Feed the orphan. Feed the children. Don't steal the inherited land from people. And we don't see that anywhere else during that era of time. We see more of the value system of take what you can take and enslave people. But we hear this voice that's there. Usually, the ones who voiced that ended up at the bottom of the well or in jail or somewhere, persecuted. So that took us back to about 1000 BEC, but there it was. And then we asked the question again, where did that come from? And so then we looked at the story of the Great Mother, the Dark Mother, and we looked at the possibility, and we've gone back 30,000 years BCE because we're trying to find the origins of things, and we find the possibility that there was a unified belief system that came with the migration out of Africa, and in this unified belief system that came with this migration out of Africa had the values of transformation and compassion and justice. And these were marked values in this migration. So is it possible that universal love, universal compassion, or those ideals were simply the way of life of human beings at one point in time? Was that the norm? Was empathy for who we are and our community, and then when we met other human beings, was empathy just part of the normal process as we greeted one another and encountered one another? Was empathy a dominant feeling state from one human being to another human being, from one community to another community, from one region to another region? Was the value and the experience of empathy dominant? I don't find empathy dominant today in our culture. I don't find the value of empathy, if I would be allowed into board meetings of large groups of people and large businesses, that empathy is a primary value when people decide to do certain things and move factories, or the effects of their decision-making process, what effects that would have on families, what effects that would have on the environment. I don't find empathy being a high value. Usually empathy is not a high profit value. So we're back and we're looking at these years, and now we've talked about patriarchy impinging upon patriarchy being when a group of people, when people, civilization or a country or marked out people in a territory have considered this thought that no matter what, we're right and you're wrong and we can do what we want, and it's male dominated, male rule dominated. But more importantly than that, it is that we are superior than you and we can treat you how we want to treat you. It doesn't matter. So we see these kingdoms, the Persian kingdom, the Babylonian kingdom. We see these kingdoms rise up and do these things. The kingdom of Israel, the same thing happened. So then I was reading Gerda Lehner, And this year it came up. She said that the completion of patriarchy was 500 BCE. That's the completion. It's a 2,500-year period. And so what she does is she says that patriarchy is a thing. It is something in itself. It's not innately human. It was something that was created, something that evolved out of what it means of how people relate to one another. But when I heard that year, 500 BCE, my ears went, what? And when you're reading, you hear stuff like, wait a minute. Over here, we have the Hebrew prophets around the same era of time. Okay. We also have at the same era of time the creation of salvationist religions. If you remember when we looked at that and studied that the relation of salvation religions were a result of an oppression, and the salvation religions, the Hebrew religion, Buddhist thought pattern, the Hindu thought pattern. So now all of a sudden, right around this era of time, 1000 BCE and 500 BCE, we've got these salvationist religions that are emerging. We got the Hebrew prophets that are emerging. We got the completion of patriarchy emerging. And my mind's going, this is getting complicated for me, and I'm having a hard time putting all this together. But I do know this. Something unique happened in that era of time that is still with us today. I do know that. So now to complicate it for me even further. I'm reading in the Greek history, trying to understand the works of the Apostle Paul, trying to understand the relationship between Paul's teaching in the New Testament and the teachings of Jesus. When Paul says, let this mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus. Let this mind be in you. I'm going, well, how does that work? How do I take a mind that's in somebody else and put that mind in me and become that? How does that work? What does that mean? So then I come across Anaxagoras' work in 500 BCE. He begins to talk about, remember that year, 500 BCE. So now we've got Anaxagoras 500 BCE, we got the salvationist religions around the same time, the Hebrew prophets around the same time. So we've got a lot. And what he says is that the human being is capable of having an intellect and reason that's separate from the body. That our minds, the purest mind, the purest reason, is separate from the body. Now, I've been doing pastoral counseling and reading in the development of the mind of the human being for over 20 years. And when you read in modern literature and psychological literature, when the mind separates from the body, it's called a dissociative state. It's not something positive. And the therapeutic and the counseling work is to integrate the mind and the body in a sense so that your body has a voice in your life. I got to thinking about that and thinking about my own life, and I know that if my body has had a powerful choice in my own life, as my mind has had, I would have done a lot of things different in my history. Because I've done a lot of things to my body that if my body had a voice, said, do not do this, Gregory. Don't do this. Right? How many of us in our minds that we know if our body had a voice, we'd be different? Somehow we are fostering the separation of this mind-body. Now, Anaxagoras, he's writing, he's already in a culture that's oppressive. He's already in a culture, when we looked at the salvationist religions, the dissociative aspects of that. He's already in a culture where that exists. And now he's saying that this mind, which through the next several hundred years becomes the divine mind, he didn't call it that, but through Plato and through others called the divine mind, through the Apostle Paul, the mind of Christ. See, his writings just didn't come from the life of Jesus and him. His writings come from a history. So when the Apostle Paul's talking about let this mind be in you, it's the divine mind that they're talking about, which stems back to, are we now having a positive value on the mind separated from the body? And we're calling it the divine mind. Do we now, and how many of us have heard the thinking of mind, body, and soul, spirit, and we begin to separate ourselves into these different pieces? I'm suggesting that pre-patriarchy, I'm suggesting that when there was that universal belief system of transformation and compassion, there was no separation. That separation is an artificial separation to try to understand what's happening to people as they grow up in a culture that's oppressive to them. I can remember watching, must have been something like Discovery Channel or something of that, and the Western mind was analyzing, bearing upon this man. He was standing in one of those thin boats, which when you ever see that and you look at it, how can he stand in that without knocking it over? One of those like a kayak. And he was paddling through islands, and he could paddle to an island that he couldn't see necessarily on the horizon. And they were wondering, how does this man know how to navigate? He doesn't read the stars. He doesn't have a compass. And the person said, they just know. They're part of the environment. They're not separate from the environment. He was part of the environment. And what I'm suggesting today is we have moved into a place where we idealize and value mind-body separation, and we think it's okay, and we think it's a good thing. Now, when he began to say that there is this mind, this intellectual mind that's separate, I'm thinking he's working on saving how he thinks in his own imagination. He's saying, how can I survive in this culture unless I retreat? Unless I back up. Unless I separate myself. See, that makes sense. Because here he's doing that at 500 BC. Detachment from the world to save his own imaginative process. Clear around the world. Here's Buddha saying the same thing. You are to detach from this world and back up and retreat within yourself in order to figure out this world. Here's the Apostle Paul. Here's Jesus. All these people are beginning to say, you have to detach from the external world in order to have spiritual health. That's a problem. That's a problem. Because if I have to totally detach from the external world, what am I saying about the external world?
You don't live within the world.
What am I saying about it? I'm saying I cannot stand it.
Amen.
It is toxic to me. So I got to have some kind of process to back up. I was trying to think of when we do that, and I've practiced meditation and have done that, there is a re-entry, and different in that re-entry. And there are also events in our culture where that happens, and I wonder if we ever come back. For example, how many of you, when John Kennedy was assassinated, or Martin Luther King, or Robert Kennedy, how many of you retreated in your psyche and did not come back? How many of you had hope when you heard the words of John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy? And you had hope for this nation. And maybe the divine mind of the nation was trying to re-enter daily life. But then at their deaths, that nurturing transformation, justice quality retreated. And we have a hard time bringing it back in and actualizing in our behavior. The day after some of the presidential elections in the recent decade, I know this congregation went in, and I don't know if we've come back out. the divine mind, wisdom, and perfect behavior. The middle ground of wisdom is the battleground for our own souls. For in the wisdom is our imaginative life. In the wisdom is our reflecting, meaning-making process. In the wisdom is how we determine how we're going to relate to one another. And there is great effort that I have experienced in my life and that I have seen when I read through history. Great effort to diminish that realm of wisdom in our psyches, in our imagination, so that other people make decisions for us and we no longer make our own decisions. And I know that when I make decisions that are not healthy for my body, that I know that my mind and my body are so separated, it is an indication that that aspect of wisdom is diminished. Because when wisdom is alive and when wisdom is healthy, I make good decisions for myself. I make good decisions in relationships. I argue less. I'm less obstinate. I break through the denial. When the protester came to protest a service of remembrance of the outcome of the value system of our nation, empty boots. To me, it's like the addict not wanting to look at the havoc that they caused the night before. Wisdom calls us to look at the disorder we cause in our own lives and the lives of others. Wisdom preempts the decisions that move us to disorder and chaos. The wisdom piece between the divine mind and perfect behavior needs to be fed and enlivened. It needs to be invigorated. And we need to protect that, as we talked about last time with the work of William Ellery Channing. We need to protect that aspect of ourselves with a rigorous attitude. And our spiritual work to give our body back its voice, we will begin to make the right decisions in our lives. There is nobody alive that when their body has a voice, that I would choose to pollute my body, nor would I choose to pollute this planet when my body has a choice. My innate process of who I am as a human being moves through empathy, and that's part of my body. And when I know there's a lack of empathy within me, I know that that wisdom that goes between the divine mind and the behavior has been injured. Our work with this understanding that we live in a culture that teaches us to be divided within, when my understanding is that what it means to be human, there are no divides. We are just one. Is we have to work to get to that oneness. So when we talk about peace, I don't have to bring up anti-war. I can just talk about peace as being of a value in and of itself. I don't have to stand over and against something else. Then I can begin to understand universal love. Then I can begin to look at my imaginative process through my history, and I can see if there is a place in my own self where universal love does not apply or universal compassion does not apply within my own self and then others. But it's this place of wisdom that we need to get to, and we need to nurture, and we need to care about, and we need to protect.